All right, I actually got interested in this through being interested in muon colliders, and then that kind of evolved into neutrino factories. So I have to admit to you, I'm not really a neutrino expert. So if I get something wrong, please forgive me. All right, so I'm going to go back and forth. I'm going to talk a little bit about physics for the muon collider, physics for the neutrino factory, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the accelerator R&D. Please feel free to ask me questions.
Can you turn out that light on the screen?
Oh yeah, I was going to do that, but I didn't. I got distracted. Good idea.
Oh, no.
Oops. Okay, yes, much better. Okay. All right, why would we, do we have a pointer or something? Yes, here it is. Why would we want to have a muon collider? Well, muons are fundamental particles, just like electrons, so we have the same advantage as well-known E plus E minus colliders. The energy of the interaction is the full energy of the particle, since both electrons and muons are fundamental particles, and so we don't have to worry about the reduction factor due to colliding protons and antiprotons, because we don't have to worry about just the collisions of quarks and gluons. And that's worth about a factor of 10 on the average in center of mass energy. Okay, second reason is synchrotron radiation by muons is much less than for electrons. That's the reason why people are going from the circular E plus E minus storage rings to linear colliders, because when you get to high enough energy, the power lost by radiation becomes excessive and you have to pay for that. Reduction factor is the ratio of the masses to the fourth power, and so that's about 6 times 10 to the minus 10.
Can I interrupt already? So,
yes.
So this factor of 10 in the first line, I would have thought it would be much bigger, because, so this is saying mean x of a parton and a high energy hadron is about a third?
Right.
And you square that?
So it's like Fermilab at 2 TeV is equivalent on the average to LEP at 200 GeV, okay? And so the reach, say, for finding a Higgs particle would be the same. The only advantage you have from the antiproton collider is that you have a distribution function of the energy of the partons, and if you get to high enough luminosity, then you can get out on the high energy tail. So you can actually get to higher energy.
Yeah, the 10 only takes into account this higher luminosity, I guess. If you just take
the just taking the average. No, I mean, it's on the average, okay? You can get higher with proton antiproton if you have high enough luminosity. Of course, you can't do that with electron positron because you're just limited to the energy that each of the beams have.
But with a mean x per hadron of a third, so you're already selecting for the energy tail.
A little bit, yeah, yeah.
If you just take a typical soft event, it would be a 10 to the 5th or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not talking about soft events.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's a little bit more explicit on the next slide I have. Okay, where people have actually done some more calculation. Okay, so I talked about the power. The other thing is that because you have less synchrotron radiation, the muon beam can have a very narrow energy spread. And that could be an advantage if you are trying to run on, say, a Higgs resonance, I'll talk about that, and measure the mass and the width of the Higgs boson very precisely. It's the same thing that was done at LEP for the Z, except now we don't have we don't have very much radiation from the muon. Okay, and because of that, we can make a high-energy collider with mu plus mu minus, and we can make it much smaller, because we don't have to worry about the radius of curvature of the magnets. So just to put that in a little bit of perspective, here's a sketch of a comparison of various energy machines which are proposed or are being built with the various energy muon colliders. Okay, here's LHC, okay? And this is, here's the energy equivalent here that somebody calculated, 1.5 to 2.3 TeV with an actual center of mass energy of 14 TeV. Okay, so at the lower end, it's about a factor of 10. And then depending on how much luminosity you get, you go higher. So this is a little bit more accurate presentation of that. I always just remember it as about a factor of 10. Okay, So the LHC is colliding protons with protons at 14 TeV center of mass energy, and that's equivalent to about 1.5 to 2.3 TeV if you were colliding fundamental particles like electrons or muons. Okay, the SSC, which we once thought about building, 40 TeV would be this big, and equivalent energy 2 to 6.7 TeV. Some people want to make another step and go to VLHC at 100 TeV. Also, this, it's the same energy, but the lower magnetic field, this pipetron. Okay, huge. Okay, the NLC, which is 500 GeV to 1 TeV, would be about this long. Okay, kind of about the diameter of the SSC. And here's the size of the Fermilab site and the Brookhaven site relative to these machines. And then if you look at mu plus mu minus collider, you can have a Higgs factory running at, say, 100 GeV, and it would be like this, tiny, okay? Or 400 GeV, be like this, or even 3 TeV would be like this. So even that, 3 TeV would fit on either the Fermilab site or the Brookhaven site.
What's the structure of those
circles? I'll say more about that. The reason is that you would go through several stages of acceleration and cooling, presumably before you would get to the final storage ring. The larger circle, of course, is the high energy storage ring where you're producing the mu plus mu minus collisions. We have lots of rings in this, and I'll say more about that. Okay, so this gives you an idea of what you could gain if only you could figure out how to collide mu plus and mu minus beams with sufficient luminosity. Intriguing, right? Okay, so here are some physics issues for the muon collider. Is there a light Higgs boson? I'll say more about this, but it seems that the data are suggesting yes. If there's only one light Higgs boson, then it's crucial to measure its properties. Presumably it would already be discovered at LHC or possibly the Tevatron, but still, you would like to be able to measure its properties very well. You won't know at that point whether it's a standard model Higgs or a supersymmetric Higgs. At the muon collider, the Higgs is produced through the S channel, not through the Higgs-Strahlen reaction, which is the case with E plus E minus linear colliders. I'll say more about that. We could also measure CP properties of the Higgs boson through asymmetries with transversely polarized mu plus and mu minus beams. That's pretty technical, and I won't have time to go into that. I can give you some references.
Is it also very difficult to make that polarization?
It's not so difficult to make the polarization. I mean, the muon is polarized naturally. No, well, you have to turn it around, but there are ways to do it. Yeah, there are ways to do it. The main thing, I think, is to keep the polarization through the whole acceleration cooling storage process.
For John Arnold and myself, who spent many years at SPEAR trying to utilize the polarization of E-plasma-minus beams.
Okay.
So
hey, me too. It went away. But I mean, maybe we're cleverer these days. Anyway, Jack Gunion has some papers on this. There are quite a few people who have written a lot of theoretical papers on how you can do this. But that's a whole talk in itself. So I'm not going to say more about that later. Okay. Muon collider in the Higgs mass range would be the first step, and that would be maybe 100 or so GeV if we want to do the lowest mass Higgs, or who knows where if we have supersymmetry, where the supersymmetric Higgses would be. I don't mean they're supersymmetric, but the big H and the big A, for example. And that we might ultimately be able to get to an energy of 3 to 4 TeV, and the limitation at that energy is actually, you won't believe this, neutrino radiation. We think we could design the lattice in such a way and provide enough shielding that 3 to 4 TeV would be okay. I think maybe it would be problematic to go to 10 TeV, but still, 3 to 4 TeV is interesting. Okay. More about the S-channel Higgs production. This shows a cross-section for producing the Higgs at a Higgs factory and some comparisons. We should redo this cross-section. It's a little bit ugly. Some comparisons with, there's too much stuff on it. Calhoun once got mad at me for not giving him credit, so okay, here's his credit, he says. I'll get him to do a better one. But anyway, the real comparison here is with the NLC Higgs, which is way down here, several orders of magnitude lower in cross-section. But of course, you have to get the luminosity. Okay, so we can produce the Higgs boson in the S channel. That is, mu plus mu minus goes to Higgs. We're on a resonance, just like doing the Z at a Z factory. Okay, we don't use Higgs Dahlem. And the small beam energy spread can allow a measurement of the mass of the Higgs to a few hundred keV. Okay, which I think is better than you can do at the linear collider, the E plus E minus linear collider, and you could make a direct measurement of the Higgs width to about 1 MeV. So we could call this a Higgs factory. We can produce Higgses and measure them to our heart's delight. Okay, this is the latest version of the fit to the precision electroweak data, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but it shows that we probably, if this is correct, we have, well, it's even correct if you take into account supersymmetric Higgses, but it looks like we should have a rather low mass Higgs. Okay, and here are some arguments why we might be in a regime of supersymmetry if we have supersymmetry, where a muon collider could be interesting. If we have a light Higgs boson in supersymmetry, about 120 GeV, then that could indicate a large value of tangent beta. I'm happy to argue about these points, by the way. Now, this one, of course, is in a state of who knows what, depending on what you use for the corrections. But if the muon anomalous magnetic moment disagrees with the standard model prediction, that's in the direction of indicating a large tangent beta.
That disagreement partially went away when
I know.
Discovered a couple of weeks
yes.
ago.
Yes. Oh, a new error.
Another error?
Oh, my gosh. Which is this? Well,
this
maybe
is an error in using E plus E minus data.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Not an error in the measurement, an error
right,
in the theoretical
right.
prediction.
Yes. Well, this seems to go around all over the place, and it's whether you use the hadronic data or the tau data, and there's all sorts of arguments.
The discrepancy between those two usages is also diminished.
Really? Okay.
Discrepancy between either them and the measurement.
This situation here is kind of wildly fluctuating, so we don't know. But if there were, I can't, you know, I'm not an expert on this. But if it turned out that we did have a disagreement, then at least in the direction it was before, it could indicate a large value of tangent beta. At least it was consistent with that. Okay. Now you could be in this regime. In the decoupling limit, and in the decoupling limit, you have the lowest mass Higgs boson, the little H0, has couplings like the standard model Higgs, but the heavier Higgses, the big H0 and the A0, would have non-standard model couplings, and the coupling to gauge bosons would be suppressed. Okay, so that makes it more difficult, for example, to produce them in a Higgs-Dahlem-like interaction, but it doesn't suppress the coupling to mu plus mu minus, because this is not a gauge boson. Okay, so for larger values of tangent beta, there's a range of heavy Higgs boson masses for which discovery, even at the LHC, or, well, at an E plus E minus linear collider, I think you could do it if you had sufficient energy, but you need more energy there than you would in a mu plus mu minus collider, because you would have to produce pairs of them. Okay? And let me show the this picture, right at this point. This is a plot, another one of these complicated plots, which shows the discovery range for Higgs bosons, supersymmetric Higgs bosons at the LHC, and this was produced by somebody in ATLAS for an integrated luminosity of 300 inverse femtobarns. And you can find the little h, okay, but in this region indicated in here, with, say, moderate tangent beta from, I don't know, 3 up to maybe, I don't know, whatever this is, 15 or so, you could be in a regime where you would not be able to find the big H and the big A at the LHC. So in this regime, you could possibly need a muon collider, okay? This would be for the big H and the A in the region of, say, oh, maybe 200, I don't know, up to what, 500 GeV. Okay, so this scenario is entirely consistent with everything we know from data, which is maybe not very much at this point. Okay? All right, and another point is that heavy Higgs bosons in this regime are largely degenerate in the MSSM. And this is a plot of this. We can find, for example, tangent beta here is 5 or 10. The mass of the A0 is 350 GeV. And you can see the big H and the big A are almost on top of each other for tangent beta of 10. So you need a very good energy resolution in order to resolve that situation. Okay, so that's, anybody have any questions about that? I'm going to go on now and talk a little bit about the next step, neutrino factories. Okay, well, why, again, for muon storage rings? In this case, you only need to have one muon beam in the storage ring. The muons decay. Okay, either mu minus or mu plus, you could store either one. And of course, you get the usual decay, mu minus to E minus, mu, nu bar E, or mu plus to E plus, nu bar mu, nu E. And a muon storage ring could produce 10 to the 19 to 10 to the 21 muon decays per year. We would have stored muons in the energy range of 20 to 50 GeV. The stored muons could be polarized. And one interesting thing is that there's no comparable source of electron neutrinos and antineutrinos. For a muon decay, we get half muon neutrinos and half anti-electron neutrinos, for example. A normal standard neutrino beam is produced from decays of k's and pi's. So it's mostly nu sub mu's with a small fraction of nu sub e background. But it's nu sub e, not nu bar e. And this becomes interesting, as I'll tell you a little bit later. Okay, and another point is that intense beams of neutrinos can be produced to study not only neutrino oscillations, but also possible CP violation for neutrinos. So we can use a muon storage ring as a neutrino factory. Okay, so here are some of the issues. The neutrino factory could measure theta 1-3 from nu bar E oscillating to nu bar mu. I'll give some more details about this. The sine of delta M squared 3-2 using matter effects, and CP violation in the leptonic sector if the sine square 2 theta 1-3 and sine square 2 theta 2-1 and delta M squared 2-1 are sufficiently large. Okay, and here's a plot which shows the from some of the feasibility studies, which I'll talk about, the number of muon decays per year as a function of the muon energy at this region here. This is about 10 to the 18. We could discover nu sub e oscillating to nu sub mu, we already know this, and something about the sine of delta m squared. In this regime, we could study, we could be in the regime of about more than 10 to the 19 muons per year. This is per 10 to the 7. That's the SSC year, so to speak. Okay, and in this region here, we would have enough intensity to be able to study CP violation. We had two feasibility studies. The megawatts here refer to the megawatts of initial proton beams on a target. If we had 4 megawatts proton beam, we would be well in the region where we ought to be able to study CP violation. Okay, and some more detail here. I probably don't need to go through this for you, but I put it in anyway. Okay. And I'll talk a little bit about whether the effect of the matter effect. Okay, so this is what happens to the probability for neutrino oscillation from neutrino A to neutrino B in the absence of a matter effect. Okay, and if we take, for example, delta M squared atmospheric to be this difference, delta M squared 3.2, and the delta M squared for solar neutrinos to be a delta M squared 2.1, and we just assume we have this hierarchy, we don't really have to do this. And then neutrino beams from a storage ring, as I just mentioned, would have extremely high purity and would be 50% nu E and 50% nu bar E, or 50% nu bar mu and 50% nu E. Okay. Now, this is an argument about CPT invariance. If we have CPT invariance, then the probability for nu bar mu oscillating to nu bar B oscillating to nu bar A is equal to the probability for nu A oscillating to nu B. So if we set B equal to A, then the probability for not oscillation, nu bar A going to nu bar A and nu A going to nu A are equal. The transition probabilities for the CP transform reaction, nu bar A goes to nu bar B, and the time reversed reaction, nu B goes to nu A, are given by the formula on the previous transparency with the sign of the imaginary term reversed. I guess it's two previous transparencies here, okay, this term here. Okay, so the CPT, for long baseline neutrino experiments, we're really only talking about delta M squared atmospheric. And then the CP, T violation effects are negligibly small, so that in a vacuum, the probability for nu bar A oscillating to nu bar B is equal to the probability for nu A going to nu B, and the probability of nu B going to nu A is equal to the probability for nu A going to nu B. Okay. However, in matter, even in the absence of CP violation, the probability for nu bar A oscillating to nu bar B is not equal to the probability of nu A going to nu B, and I'm sure you know much more about this than I do. And then with the neutrino factory, we can use the wrong sign mu on appearance spectra as functions of delta M squared 3.2 at a baseline of something like 3,000 kilometers for both mu plus and mu minus beams to determine both the sine of delta M squared 3.2 as well as the value of sine squared 2 theta 1.3. Okay, now here's a bit about how we could do this. And this illustrates the advantage we could have with a neutrino factory. Okay, here we look at just nu mu, not oscillating, staying nu mu, and survival. Okay, we could do that with either a conventional beam or a neutrino factory. Okay, appearance, we could do that, a nu mu oscillating to a nu E, and you detect the nu E by finding an electron. This is an appearance experiment, and it could be done with either a conventional beam or a neutrino factory.
Why in both cases the detection of electrons?
Excuse me? It could be done, but I mean, it's, I don't know what you want to say. If you still have to be careful, okay? For example, in a conventional beam, you have the, I guess it depends on what you mean by with difficulty. In the conventional beam, you have a background of nu E, okay? In the neutrino factory, you still have to be careful with your detector. It requires a rather elaborate detector. And if you want to look at the electron in one of these elaborate detectors, one thing you might want to do is tell an electron from a positron, okay? And so to do that, you have to detect the electron, and then you also have to have a magnetic field so you can tell the charge sign of the particle, okay? Now, the checks are, maybe this is not the right terminology here. It can be done, but you have to do some work. But for some of these, you really can't do it. The interesting ones are probably these. Okay? And then you could also measure nu mu oscillating to nu tau. And again, that would be the appearance of the tau minus. Okay? And here again, you're looking for the same sign electron or muon as you started out with, because a nu mu would produce a nu minus. Okay? Now, here, the nu bar E oscillating, nu bar E surviving and producing an E plus. Okay, well, in a conventional beam, you wouldn't do that because you don't have nu bar E's. You could have a small fraction of them, 10 to the minus 4 or so, if you decayed a K plus or a pi plus. Okay, but you wouldn't even think about doing that. You can do this with the neutrino factory. Okay? And then the corresponding case up here, we have a nu bar E oscillating to a nu bar mu. You detect the nu bar mu through a mu plus. Now, if you have a nu bar E, then you also have a nu mu, right, from the mu decay. The nu mu would produce a mu minus. Okay, so the nu plus would be very distinctive from that. And then a nu bar E oscillating to a nu bar tau, again, you would produce a tau plus, which would decay to an E plus or a mu plus. And again, you would produce this nu bar E with a nu mu, which would produce a mu minus. So the particle that you're looking for the appearance of would produce a lepton of the opposite charge sign from the background. So it's quite distinctive.
As an aficionado of the liquid argon detectors for this application, I would say that if we had a liquid argon detector, the magnetic field change those checks to stars.
Okay, maybe, yeah. I mean, there's maybe some question about whether you call it check or star.
No, you can't.
Yeah, these require kind of a, what do you want to call it, third generation of muon detector or electron detector?
Something like that.
Anyway, it's
you can change the check to dollar sign.
Ah, yes. Okay, but anyway, maybe I should rework this table, but the point I wanted to make here is that you have a very different situation with regard to looking for what happens with the nu mu. Okay, that's not so different, but what happens with nu bar E? Forget it. You can't do that with a conventional beam. All right, now here's an illustration of what happens with the matter effect and how you can use that to determine the sine of delta M square 3, 2. Okay, so we have four situations here. Okay, this is for 10 to the 20 muon decays and a 50 kiloton detector. And you're looking for wrong sign muon appearance. Okay? Wrong sign muon appearance. If we go back to the other table, you can imagine what this is. You're running with, say, a mu minus beam, and you're looking for a mu plus. Okay? So this is an experiment that you would do by running both a mu plus beam and then a mu minus beam. Okay? So for the mu plus beam, you would have this distribution in terms of detecting the wrong sign muon, depending on whether delta M squared is negative or positive. And then for a mu minus beam, you would have this situation terms of the, and I've forgotten what this color code is. I have to look. Oh, okay. This is the, what?
Delta M squared.
Yeah, delta M squared. Oh, yes. These are the different values of delta M squared. Okay. Yes. Okay, I told you I wasn't a neutrino expert. Prepared these about a year ago. Okay, so then with a mu minus beam, then you also have this corresponding case, and you sort of have a reversal here. Here, if delta M squared is negative, you have this distribution, and if delta M squared is positive, you have this distribution. Okay? So then you can tell the sign of delta M squared just for looking at that distribution. Okay, and then you can look at the asymmetry, okay, the number of nu bar E's oscillating to nu bar mu's divided by the number of nu E's oscillating to nu mu as a function of delta M square 3,2. And you can get two different curves depending on whether delta M squared is positive or negative. Now, this was a calculation that was done. Well, there are several parameters involved here. This was done as a function of baseline, so this gives you an idea of what kind of baseline you'd like to have for this experiment. Okay? Very short baselines are not so good because the difference isn't that large. Okay? The widths of the bands, I'll mention this here, show the predictions as a CP violating phase varies from minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2. And then we have statistical error bars, and that would correspond to 10 to the 21 mutagens and a 50 kiloton detector. Okay? And then the bands for delta M square 32 less than 0, delta M square 32 greater than 0, and this was done for delta M square 32 of 0.0035 EV squared and delta M square 21 of 5 times 10 to the minus 5 EV squared and sine square 2 theta 13 of 0.004. Okay.
It's from that you win going to shorter baseline because your statistical error bars are very small. And then you can.
Your statistical error bars are very small, but you don't know what the CP violating phase is.
I thought the interpretation of that is that if you measure the point very accurately, you determine the CP violating phase, no?
Now let's see.
Not at the shortest baseline.
No.
Degenerate.
Yeah.
Yeah, just went right.
It's degenerate there. You want to be somewhere in here, okay, where you have reasonable statistics and some separation. Okay, so this is something which I believe is not possible to do with a conventional neutrino beam. Now there may be some people who would argue with me. You think you can do it?
Have I confused things now? You were talking originally about a Higgs factory and now about neutrino factory. Are they different or the same?
They're different. What the neutrino factory is, and I'll emphasize this again. First, I was just talking about the physics, okay? For a Higgs factor, you're colliding a mu plus with a mu minus. For a neutrino factory, all you have is a storage ring with one muon beam at a time, okay? You could either have mu plus or you could have mu minus. Okay, so the way we see this is as a step. Well, it depends on what your physics interest is, but you can see this as sort of a phase program. In fact, you could think of it as a phase program. I'll go through this later. Maybe I can just say it now. You could go from, say, a super beam. Okay, you could have a very high a very high intensity, high power proton beam, and so you could produce a very high intensity neutrino beam, and you could get a much better measurement of the parameters involved. Okay, and from that, you would know something about whether you could go ahead and complete. Well, you could measure whether you could measure CP violation or not, for example, or whether you could go ahead and measure it with a conventional beam, or whether you would need to have a neutrino factory. Okay. In addition to that, there are other experiments you can do, which I'll mention in passing. Okay. Then, if you need to go ahead and do the neutrino factory, you would go to the muon storage ring, where you would store one muon. Now, the big difference here is that you don't have to make this muon beam small. The only limitation is you want to make it small enough so you can get it through your magnetic field, your lattice, your apertures. That's the only limitation. But if you want to collide a mu plus with a mu minus, you have to make both beams very small in order to make the luminosity high. And I'll mention this. Okay, so this could be seen as a step from, well, like maybe a four-phase step. Super beam, neutrino factory, Higgs factory, and high energy mu plus mu minus collider, if you're positive. Yes?
Since you brought up the smallness of the beam, what is the current situation with regard to the mice, the proposed mice experiment?
Yeah, I'll mention this if I get to it. We've made a submission. There's a panel which is considering it, and they're supposed to decide something when they meet on May 2nd, is my understanding. So it's
close.
Positive, yeah. And all we got to do is get the U.S. government to give us some money. forget it, right. All right. So a quick summary here. We can measure theta 13 from nu bar E oscillating to nu bar mu. We can measure the sine of delta M square 32 using matter effects. And then we can do the CP violation in the leptonic sector, sine square 2 theta 13, sine square 2 theta 21 and delta M squared 21 are sufficiently large. All right, now I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing in the R&D. Two neutrino factory feasibility studies have been carried out, one based at Fermilab, although really done by the whole collaboration. The other done based at Brookhaven, but again done by the whole collaboration. And we're now talking about a study three, which some people would like to see based in England. There's a lot of enthusiasm right now in the UK for a neutrino factory. Okay, so I'll just go through. This is the, just to give you an idea of what's involved here, this is the schematic for the neutrino factory, which is the Study 2 version, which was fixed to be located on the Brookhaven site, but could be located elsewhere. You have a proton driver. You hit a target. You produce pions in the target. The pions decay. You have mini cooling here, which is 3.5 meters of liquid hydrogen for the cooling. I'll talk a little bit about cooling, and about 10 meters of drift. And then you have some bunching, and then you have more cooling. This is 108 meters of cooling, which I'll show you what it looks like. And then you have a LINAC to accelerate the beam. Then you put it in the recirculating LINAC to accelerate it from 2.5 to 20 GeV. And then you put the 20 GeV beam in the muon storage ring, and that produces the neutrino beam. Let me emphasize that when the pions are produced from the target, they are not at all what you would call a beam. They have a very large phase space. And so the muons resulting from the decay are also in a very large phase space. And so what you have to do in this section is try to get the muons, as many of them as possible, into a small phase space. So that's what this mini cooling region is for. And just a little bit about some of the details of the study. The target would have to accommodate a 4-megawatt proton beam, as I mentioned. And one way that this might be done is to have a liquid mercury jet target. Okay? And this is then inside superconducting coils to focus the muons or the pions that are produced. And here's a schematic of how that might look. Okay? You have the jet of liquid mercury. You have a mercury containment vessel. The mercury falls down and lands in this pool. There's a beryllium window here. There's actually an experiment that's been done, Brookhaven experiment E951, which hopefully will continue. And what was done there was showing that protons impinging on liquid mercury jet did not cause too much disruption in the jet immediately. These little pictures here show the mercury jet at various times after it was struck by 2×10^12 protons. And I guess I lost my milliseconds down here, 0.7527 and 18 milliseconds. So you see that the beam is not sufficiently broken up until you get to several milliseconds after the protons hit it. Now, a next step is to, this was not done in a magnetic field, so a next step would be to do this inside a magnetic field. Okay, here's a little bit of detail about the cooling channel. What's done in the cooling is we use ionization cooling. And in ionization cooling, what you do is you put the muons through some material. In this case, it's a liquid hydrogen absorber. You want to have a low Z material so that cooling dominates over heating. So here we show three cells of liquid hydrogen absorber. You need to have this inside focusing, so you use, I won't go into too much detail of this, it's called an S-FOFO arrangement of the solenoid coils. And then you, after you have the beam going through the liquid hydrogen, you have to accelerate it so that you put the momentum back in the longitudinal direction. And then that's done in superconducting RF. And this is a 201.25 megahertz RF cavity. So you have sort of three crucial items here. You have the liquid hydrogen, you have the RF cavity, and you have the superconducting solenoid. Now there were, what, 100 and some meters of this in the neutrino factory feasibility study too. That produced the cooling. And here is a plot that shows the cooling in the transverse direction. The transverse direction is shown by these green symbols here. And the longitudinal cooling, which there really isn't, is shown by the blue symbols. And you can see how much cooling there is as a function of how much, how many meters of cooling cells like this you have. And so at about 100, you don't have any more effect, really. You've done the ultimate in the transverse cooling, but you haven't done anything in the longitudinal cooling. Okay, and I mentioned a little bit about this already, so I'll go through it quickly. We can imagine studying neutrino oscillations with superbeams, then going to a neutrino factory. And here are some of the things I didn't mention. There's other physics you might imagine doing with intense cold muon beams, such as rare and forbidden processes, such as, what do you call that, mu E conversion. Mu goes to E gamma, mu goes to 3 electrons. Mu plus E minus goes to mu minus E plus. Muon decays, better measurement of the muon anomalous magnetic moment, the muon electric dipole moment, various experiments with muon spectroscopy, and muonic atoms. You can also do experiments with the neutrino beams. All right. Now, we've done the feasibility studies, some of them for the neutrino factory, and many of these studies could be applied to going ahead to do a muon collider. For example, the targetry could be more or less the same. If you've mastered that for producing the muons for your muon storage ring, the whole process of capture and decay of the pions, transverse cooling, and accelerating a large beam. However, a muon collider requires that the muon beams be cooled in addition by several orders of magnitude compared with a neutrino factory. And also, whereas in a neutrino factory, you can have many bunches of muons decaying, in a muon collider, you need the muons all to be in one bunch so that you can collide bunches of mu plus and mu minus. Okay. So just to give you an idea here, here are some parameters for a Higgs factory at 100 GeV with a 16 GeV proton energy, 4 megawatts of protons. And here you could think of having three possibilities for the momentum resolution of the muons, and that impacts on the luminosity. And here you can see the effect of that on the number of Higgses that you could produce a year with such parameters. Okay, now here's listed the six-dimensional emittance, 1.7 times 10 to the minus 10 in pi meters cubed. Okay, so this gives you an idea of what our goal would have to be for a muon collider. The luminosities then are different depending on the energy spread, 1.2 times 10 to the 32 for delta P over P of 0.12%, 2.2 times 10 to the 31 for delta P over P of 0.01%, and 10 to the 31 for 0.003%. So you have to pay a price for the high energy resolution in terms of the luminosity you could get. And that's with the same six-dimensional emittance. Here are some parameters that you could imagine for a 400 GeV mu plus mu minus collider and a 3 TeV mu plus mu minus collider. Also, using basically the same initial proton beam, 4 megawatts, and using the same six-dimensional emittance all the way along. This is the same as I showed you on the slide for the 100 GeV machine. And then producing a luminosity of 10 to the 33 centimeters to the minus 2 seconds to the minus 1 at 0.4 TeV, or 7 times 10 to the 34 at 3 TeV. So then the question is, how do you achieve this? All right. So here, somebody asked a question about all those circles. Here are some more circles, okay? What would we imagine doing? Here's a very schematic version of what we might do to produce the muons for a muon collider. One of the most crucial R&D issues for the muon collider is cooling the muons, that is making the beam smaller in 6D phase space. And one way we found to do this, and I'll say more about it, is to use what we call a ring cooler. The ring cooler can reduce the emittance of the beam in both the transverse and the longitudinal directions. Okay, we've also, I won't say much about this, we have an idea for a ring buncher, which can produce the bunching that's done in the feasibility study 2 neutrino factory design in possibly a more efficient way. I showed that, I won't go into that too much. Okay, so you need this front end here, the target, the RF phase rotation, the matching. Then you need a ring cooler, okay? The ring cooler, as I said, will reduce the emittance of the beam in both dimensions, or three dimensions, transverse and longitudinal. In addition to that, we imagine that we need additional reduction of transverse emittance using a liquid lithium lens, and then we accelerate the beams. Okay, this plot here shows approximately where we've gotten, at least in simulations with the feasibility studies. Okay, this thing means feasibility study 1, feasibility study 2. Transverse emittance is shown on the horizontal axis, longitudinal on the vertical axis. Okay, here's where we are from the feasibility studies, and then we can think of taking, say, a baseline scenario, that's those plots, those tables of parameters I showed you, down to this point here, which would indicate the sort of emittance we would need for a 100 GeV mu plus mu minus collider. Okay, so we have quite a big step to make. What do we need to do that? One step is we need longitudinal cooling. The liquid hydrogen ionization cooling channel that I showed you only produces transverse cooling. In addition, we have to produce longitudinal cooling, and the way you do that is using something called emittance exchange. And what you do with emittance exchange is, okay, you're talking about longitudinal emittance, so you have a certain spread of the beam and momentum. Okay, or along the beam direction, however you want to say it. So what you need to do is you need to produce dispersion. You need to reduce that that spread and momentum. You produce dispersion, okay, and say the easiest thing to picture is maybe a dipole. In the dipole, the lower momentum particles are bent more, the higher momentum particles are bent less. Then you want to reduce the momentum of the high momentum particles more than you reduce the momentum of the low momentum particles. So you put them in a wedge-shaped absorber, okay? This could be like your liquid hydrogen lens, liquid hydrogen cell, except that it's wedge-shaped, okay? So in doing this, what you do is you reduce the emittance as well in the longitudinal direction. And we have done many simulations of this, and it has actually been achieved in the simulations. What you need to do is produce about 100 times more cooling in each transverse and in a longitudinal direction, altogether 10 to the 6th in 6D emittance compared with the mu's from the pion decay that is starting up here. Okay, here are some ideas for emittance exchange. I won't go through those too much because these are the ones we're using now in the simulations, which do work, at least in the simulations. This is one, the first one that really produced longitudinal cooling. It was invented by Valerie Balbikoff at Fermilab. And what it does is it has sort of the classic ingredients here. It has the liquid hydrogen for the transverse cooling. Then it has, this is inside a solenoid, and inside RF, the green is RF. Okay, so this is a cell which is pretty much like the cell that I showed you for the neutrino factory feasibility study. Then in these bends here, we produce dispersion in this bending magnet, this little gray thing, and then we have a wedge. Now in this, this is a lithium hydride wedge absorber, okay? And so you do this in the turns, okay, and then you keep doing this. This produces transverse cooling. This part does emittance exchange, and you go around here many times. And in the end, what you do is you, you reduce both the transverse and the longitudinal emittance. And this is a plot that shows the emittance reduction in the three directions, actually, X and Y, those are the two transverse directions, and Z, which is the longitudinal direction, and they're both reduced. Now, in the process of this, you also have decay of the muons, so you lose some of them. So this is what it means by transmission with decay and transmission without decay. So you can see that in something like 15 turns around this, you produce cooling in both directions. There are several other versions. This one is called the RFOFO ring cooler, which Bob Palmer invented. It has a structure more or less like the cooling channel and feasibility study too, except it's in a ring. It also produces cooling in both directions. And then there's a third version, which I won't go through this. We call the quadrupole ring cooler, although they finally took the quadrupole out and only use a dipole. But the idea here is not to use a solenoid, anything but a solenoid, I guess. And this also produces cooling in both transverse and longitudinal directions. So we've shown in simulations that we can produce cooling in a ring cooler to something like a factor of 5 in the transverse and factor of 2 in the longitudinal. So we can start with the neutrino factory feasibility study simulations, which have already shown cooling to 2.5 millimeters in the transverse direction, 35 millimeters in the longitudinal direction. Then we apply the ring cooler. Now, probably we would need to apply two ring coolers. And even if you do that, you still cannot get the transverse emittance of the beam down to where you need it. You're at that point at something like the millimeter level, and you need to reduce it another factor of 10. And the lattice of the ring cooler is not such that you can do that. So you need to introduce another step, which is a lithium lens cooling. And there are people who are working on this. I don't know, Dave Klein was here, I think in February, and I don't know if he talked about that, but he's one of the people who's working on that. Okay, so with the ring cooler, we can produce cooling possibly in a more economical way. So at this point, we're thinking about using a ring cooler for a neutrino factory, because it could be far cheaper than this 100 meter long linear cooling channel. And so feasibility study 3 should include a ring cooler for the cooling and this new bunching scheme, which I really didn't have time to go into. Okay, so we have done many of the steps maybe in simulation towards being able to do a muon collider. What we have to do now is go through what we're doing now is doing more realistic simulations. You know, there are steps in these simulations. All of the accelerator people have their own simulations. What we're trying to do now is do simulations in, well, what realistic includes real magnetic fields with fringing effects and so on, material as in géant, and if all three types of ring coolers still work there, we have another problem we have to solve, which is how to get the beam in and out of the ring cooler, injection and extraction. So that's another area that we need to pursue in the near future. Okay, if we've done that, then we've made some big steps. Okay, this was done some time ago, but I'll just show it to you. This is a simulation of what happens in a muon collider detector. The problem is that you have a lot of background from the electrons from the muon decay. But you can use, yeah, so you can use some shielding. And the statement from the people who did this was that the background rates are not worse than OHC experiments. Okay, so I said I would get to this. Another step along this line, besides all of these simulations, more and more realistic, is to really show physically that something works. Okay, that's always the first step in trying to pursue one of these projects. So the first step here is to show that our sort of prototypical cooling cell actually cools. Okay, so here are the ingredients that I mentioned before. The liquid hydrogen absorbers, and those little light blue things, the cells of liquid hydrogen absorber, the RF cavities for acceleration, those are shown here, superconducting RF, and the superconducting solenoid, because this whole thing has to be done in focusing. And in addition to that, we have to measure the beam. to find out that we have indeed cooled it. So we have measurement of emittance in and emittance out with a sort of a spectrometer. And so this is the experiment that we propose to do at the Rutherford Lab. And you asked the question about the status of that. We submitted the proposal in January. There was a review committee which met, I forget when it was, February. And they gave us a set of questions to answer, the usual review committee thing. We have submitted the answers to them, and they're supposed to meet, I think, on May 2nd and give some stage of approval. And there's a whole stage of these approvals, but ending in, you know, full financial backing. You know, this is a full international collaboration, et cetera, et cetera. The various people involved in this have submitted proposals to their governments asking for money. In the U.S., we submitted a proposal to the NSF. Hopefully, we'll find out something soon about whether it was accepted. It was submitted originally back in September, and every time we look at it, it says being reviewed.
That is normal.
The usual thing. Yes, 6 months, then we're saying, now what are they going to do? Are they going to have a panel or something after that? So we don't know.
Was the committee that you mentioned that will meet again on May 2nd an international committee, or is it a committee on behalf of Rutherford Lab?
Well, Rutherford Lab put together the committee, but it's an international committee. The chair is Alan Asbury. I mean, I could, you know, there's a lot of information I could give you on this whole process, but I just wanted to mention that we hope this is our next step, a real experiment. And of course, we're working on simulations on this and then developing of the key ingredients here, the liquid hydrogen cells, the superconducting RF, and the superconducting solenoid, and trying to make it as much as we can all affordable. And I think I only have two more transparencies. So here's a summary. Development of muon storage rings can lead to neutrino factories and muon colliders. Considerable R&D has already been accomplished, but we still need to do much more. Neutrino factories may enable us to measure CP violation in the leptonic sector, and a muon collider of 3 to 4 TeV center of mass energy may be possible. And we may need a muon collider in order to discover the supersymmetric heavy Higgs bosons, the big H0 and the A0. And if you want to read up more on this, we have a nice status report that was written up last summer. And many of these issues are gone over in much more detail in the status report, which is available on the web. If you want to find it, I can show you how to find it. It's actually one of these Los Alamos archive reprints, so they didn't put the number here. Okay?